Good to have you here for Kenai Fresh Air today, part of our lineup of local programs we're bringing to you during KDLL's fall membership drive. Well, politics isn't for everyone, and keeping your name on the ballot for the better part of three decades certainly isn't for everyone, but Mike Navarre has done it. I spoke with him about getting into politics and what's changed since he first ran for the state legislature back in 1984, but we pick up the conversation with Navarre's first, almost accidental step into politics. Your junior year in high school, and there's a slot open.
Actually, middle school.
In middle school.
Seventh grade.
So this goes all the way back to seventh grade. I was not thinking about. I don't even know if my school had political office in seventh grade, but yeah. Here you are, what, 12, 13 years old, and what was that like?
Well, it was interesting. What it boiled down to is that someone from our class had to run against the other seventh grade class for vice president, and a friend of mine, Steve Arbeloski, and I think we flipped a coin, and I don't remember who won and who lost, but I ended up having to be the one that ran and was successful kind of on a fluke. It's actually kind of a funny story. I had asked Mary Willits to help me write a speech, and she gave me a speech, and she said, "Now, pause at the end of every sentence for a minute for emphasis," and she said, "Boom it out." And so I got up in front of a whole school assembly that we spoke in front of when we were campaigning. And I got up there and I started out, "My name is Mike Navarre." "I want to be your vice president." And I kept pausing for emphasis and everybody started laughing and I was embarrassed and I whipped through the rest of my speech. But everybody remembered me because I gave them a good laugh. So,
that's like the first lesson in politics is maybe not is to take those things under advisement, but to be careful in how those lessons are applied.
Absolutely, humor works.
So that's your first foray into politics, quote unquote.
Sammy Crawford was my teacher.
But I want to talk a little bit about the family experience because in talking to your brother as well, you know, family public service is a big part of the Navarre family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is that, do you suppose?
Well, you know, we grew up in a small community. My folks always gave back to the community. We know a lot of people. We've had success in our business around the state. And, you know, we live here. We care about the community. We care about the people. And so we give back. It's a lesson our folks taught us, and we carry it on.
It just makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. 30 years, my sense is that you would think that a lot has changed, but maybe not. Maybe a lot of the things are kind of the same. You know, personalities might come and go or people might come and go, but some of the same ideas are fought back and forth over time, and maybe there's not as much change as one might think.
Well, I think one of the things that's really changed a lot, at least from my perspective and observation, is that politics has gotten more polarized, meaning that the positions have gotten more polarized, and with the advent of social media, et cetera, there's so much instant communication, and there's misinformation, disinformation, and good information. So it's not just that the social media and the internet and Facebook give us all good information and accurate information. It can be confusing, and it's messaging, and it's rhetoric. And so what ends up happening is the public, I think, ends up not really knowing what to believe or really understanding the issue as well as the ones who are on councils or in the assembly or in public office at the state level or even local level. They're not sure who to believe when they're saying what. And there is a mix between there are straight shooters and there are others who are either passing on information that they've heard somewhere or putting a spin on it. You know, some people put better spin on it. Some are better communicators. And the result is it can be very, very confusing, even for the people in office, because they get inundated with all kinds of information.
It seems like maybe in the past it was easier to at least agree on what issue needed to be debated. You know, the debate has always been difficult. That's politics, you know, this idea versus that idea. But maybe now it's even more difficult to just figure out what it is we need to be talking about and why we need to be talking about it.
I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is that it seems to me, and perhaps I've just forgotten over time, I'm not sure, but even when I was observing politics before I got in it and then watching it evolve while I've been in office, it seems to me that we used to, after elections, we would focus on policy. And there'd be debate and discussion, but there would also be compromise. You'd come to the middle, which is where I think most people are in this country and in this state, somewhere in the middle, and reach solutions that were in the best interest of everybody. And then they'd change, you know, and sometimes they were popular and sometimes they were unpopular, but and they change over time. But now it seems like once an election's over, the focus becomes the next election and messaging and you know, the you know, like when I was in the legislature, we didn't have press people for the House and House majority and minority and the Senate majority and minority. We didn't have a press person. We might have had someone in our office who helped with it, but we didn't have a press office to help people, you know, get their information out. It was the legislators were communicating.
Communication has become like just such this refined thing.
It has. And on any given day on social media, you know, as soon as something happens in the legislature, boom, it's up on social media, and it's one individual's perspective about what happened on that issue. And of course, you know, I hear people talk about us, we're living in the information age, because it's so much easier now at the snap of a fingers to get all kinds of information, and not all of it's good, as we've seen from the recent stories about Facebook and the some of the campaign messages that were out there, which were fake news.
Yeah.
And now we're hearing a president who's talking about fake news, which is the established, for the most part, well-respected news organizations that he's attacking. And that's a little bit difficult to swallow. But, you know, when people say we live in the information age, I say, and the disinformation age, because that's the problem, is there's a lot out there, and sometimes it's tough to sort through.
Yeah, I wanted to get back a moment ago. You mentioned, you know, observing politics sort of before you got into it. What were the things that you observed about politics that made you say, yeah, I want to do this? Because not everybody in your family chose to go into, you know, make careers out of public service. But what were the things that said, yeah, this is something I at least want to give a shot?
Well, the biggest thing for me was that when I was growing up, I idolized my dad, and I always wanted to be like him. And my dad was in public office. And so after I got out of college, I graduated from college and I was back here, I thought about it. My initial strategy, quite frankly, was to run for the legislature, and I thought I would lose, but it would set me up for the opportunity to run for city council or borough assembly or something like that and work my way up.
And this is what year?
I was 84.
Okay.
And I won on a fluke. I was in a three-way race. There were libertarians running all over the state that year. It was a push by libertarians to get candidates in as many races as they could. Both races here on the Kenai Peninsula had libertarians in it. In the other seat, I was in that time a two-member House seat. So the district was the same. There were just two House members. And Andre Maru, a libertarian candidate, won the other seat. And I won this seat in part because the libertarian candidate, John Davis, split the votes with Merrill Sikorsky, who was a Republican candidate at the time, and I slipped in with 40% of the vote. Merrill got 39%, and John Davis got 21%. If John's not in that race, I lose.
Is that how a Democrat wins? Just get enough, get libertarians or Republicans to split the vote? It seems like that might be the only way for a Democrat to win in certain areas of the state.
You know, back then, incumbent for the seat I ran for was a Democrat. It was Hugh Malone, and he'd been there for 12 years.
Sure,
And was very well respected. And it was a little bit different time. And I still think, even today, the public makes their decisions in large part based on who they trust, how you communicate with them. And so if they get to know you, and I think that's one of the things that's helped me in my political career on the Kenai Peninsula, is that I grew up here. I had a lot of brothers and sisters, so my folks were here and were well-respected. My dad was in public office, and so, you know, I had a lot of benefits, I guess, that helped me in my career, and, you know, a lot of people in the community knew me. They've watched me grow up from a young age, and then beyond that, I think they've watched and followed the things that I've done in office and have For the most part, I think I've got a good reputation, and I think that very, very much helps.
What were the issues of the day in that first race for State House? What were you sort of stumping on then?
You know, it's always been an issue of the budget. The budget's always been an issue, and I think always will be, because it's how we pay for services that we expect from state government. You know, the permanent fund dividend was not a big deal at the time because it was fairly new. It wasn't that big then. The first one in 1980 was, but the ones after that were fairly small because mm-hmm. it was a percentage of the earnings. So the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend were not as big an issue then. Roads, road maintenance, road improvements, that was an issue that was talked about a lot at the time. We were constructing schools. Here on the Kenai Peninsula, a bond issue had passed that they were constructing schools. That was when Skyview was built. That was also when Nikiski High School, junior, senior high, was built, and Homer High School. All of those were on the same bond package, and they passed overwhelmingly. There was reimbursement from the state, I think, was at 90% at the time. And we probably built more schools maybe than we needed at the time. In fact, Skyview didn't open for several years because there wasn't adequate funding or enough students to really justify it. And then it eventually did open.
I'm looking back, you know, say over the course of like 60 years in this, you know, 85, 86 being relatively the midpoint. I'm curious, my thought maybe as somebody who hasn't been here all that long is that life on the peninsula around that time was much closer to the way it was, you know, immediate post-war homesteader style, much closer to that than it is close to where we are now in 2017.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I grew up, our family homesteaded in Nikiski, so we still got the homestead out there. And growing up in the 60s, we watched all of the impacts from oil and gas development in the Cook Inlet, because that was the heyday for mm-hmm. oil and gas in Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet oil and gas production peaked in 1978. So in the 60s, it was being built. You know, the plants were being cleared. Tesoro was being built. The only one that was there before was the Chevron plant. It was built, I think, in the late 50s.
Yeah.
Was when it was built, the Chevron refinery. And so when they started developing Cook Inlet with the platforms, tremendous amount of people, economy was just incredibly hot. It was, in fact, it was overheated. We had so many families moving up here for jobs because there was good jobs, a lot of economic activity going on. When I was in junior high school, we split shifted for 1 year because we had too many students and no schools to accommodate, and we couldn't build the schools fast enough. And so what we did is that half the students went in the morning, half went in the afternoon. And we started early and finished fairly early, and then the other ones had to go in the afternoon. And so it was only for 1 year, or maybe even part of 1 year, that happened. And then we eventually built the other schools that yeah. we're currently in.
But it speaks to the challenge of trying to you know, have a community adapt to those changing conditions in an industry like that, that is so up one day and down the next.
Oh yeah, I tell people when I was a kid, I could fish on the Kenai River and we would not see maybe one or two boats all day long.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you can almost walk across the river on boats.
Change happens really fast here. Is that something that you, I'm asking, you know, this is me as the outsider asking someone who has watched it kind of happen around them. Does it feel fast, or is it just like the way it is?
You know, I guess looking back, it's kind of gone in spurts, but it has been fast. I can remember when the road was not paved. The highways through town, or the roads through town, we didn't have any highways. We didn't have any stoplights. Everybody who went through town, we had a grocery store, and so us kids, when we were young, we'd have a little Kool-Aid stand out front and, you know, get some cookies and Kool-Aid and stuff, and everybody stopped because everybody knew it was us.
Yeah.
And nowadays, that's one of the things that's significantly changed, is that there's a lot of people who've come and gone and passed on from those days. But, you know, it's evolved, and I think that it's brought some significant changes, not all of them good. but also some very significant opportunities. People have had a lot of success as a result of economic development and opportunities that present themselves and their families. And so from that aspect, it's been good. Some of the other social consequences of it, including, you know, drug use, crime, things like that have not always, I guess they're not good things for the community, but they're a fact of the matter whenever you have growth and changing dynamics and changing economics.
You're listening to my conversation with outgoing Borough Mayor Mike Navarre. This is part of our special all-local programming during day two of the KDLL Fall Membership Drive. If you've not had an opportunity yet, would like to show your support for your local public radio station, give us a call, 283-8433. So going back into that that first term at the State House, was that an easy transition into Juneau for that first time around? Was that a kind of a rude awakening as to what life is like in Juneau and how the process worked and all these things?
Well, there was a couple of things that were, I guess, surprises to me. I had heard before I went to Juneau, I'd only been to Juneau one time before that, but I'd heard, you know, how much it rains in Juneau, and I thought, yeah, they're over-embellishing. It can't possibly rain that much in Juneau. And I got to Juneau, my first year in Juneau was the session of 1985. I don't think we saw the sun more than twice in 120 days, which was the session limit at the time. That session limit had just passed. So 120 days, and I thought, wow, if this is how it's going to be, you know, it's raining all the time. Well, it was good that it happened the first year because we never had a year that bad since then. And, during the 12 years I served in the legislature. So that part of it was good. In terms of what I was expecting, it was significantly different because I was used to people that I knew who were legislators, you know, the Clem Tillion and Hugh Malone, who I knew fairly well, Don Gilman, who was in the legislature, Pat O'Connell, who was a former teacher and friend who passed away now, but he was in the legislature, and I knew those people, and I respected them. And I had, like I think a lot of people do, I had put the legislature on a pedestal. And when I got to Juneau, one of the things that was enlightening to me was that it's just people, and it's a cross-section of society, and we don't, and this is not a slight towards people who are in office, we don't elect always the best and brightest. It's just because we're only picking from those who throw their names in a hat. Remember, we don't get to select them based on
it's not an open roll call.
No, it's those who run are your choices. And you select from that, and people win and lose elections based on all kinds of different factors. But when I got down there and I realized that, wow, they don't belong on a pedestal. They're just people. And there are some who are very smart, some who are not so smart, some who work hard, some who are lazy, some have good personalities, some have bad personalities. All the different things that you see in society is reflected also in people in the legislature. And so that was something that opened my eyes up, and I've told, you know, high school classes when I've spoken to them, and even in public settings, I've said, you know, it's not the best and brightest, it's just the people who were elected, and we need to keep that in mind because it's a tough job, it's an important job, and as my father said, it can be a thankless job, and it's tough to explain what happened in Juneau. I was asked numerous times, why did this happen? And I think through it and I said, wow, how do I explain this? Because here's how it happened. It may have been that you need 21 votes in the House. So when someone asks, why did that happen? Well, on the more complicated issues, there's oftentimes only a handful of people who grasp all of the different nuances of the legislation and the issues. And then there's other people who sit on the committees and learn a little bit, and there's others who don't sit on the committees that deal directly with that issue. And so they're relying on talking with their colleagues and learning from them. And oftentimes there's a trust factor involved. If they think someone knows and understands the issue and they like the way that they explain it, then they may just vote with them because they trust that other legislator. And then there's lobbyists and the influence that lobbyists can have. And there's also always been sort of urban issues and rural issues, and sometimes the rural issues and the rural legislators are more concerned about their districts, often what they should be, than on state issues. And I mean, that can happen with urban legislators too. I don't
right,
mean that.
Yeah,
but there's,
yeah.
There's always been an urban-rural divide, and sometimes it leads to, you know, you hear about the trade-offs where somebody got something for their vote. Do those things happen? I suppose I'd have to say yes, they do, because if you see somebody getting a new school in their district, which was fourth on the list, and the number two school didn't get funded, why did that happen? It may be because of the position that the person who represents that area was in. If they're chairman of the finance committee or in leadership positions, it gives them better ability to influence decisions in the legislature. Things like that. So there, it's tough to explain how the legislature really works in simplistic terms, because it's a very complicated process and oftentimes can be very frustrating.
Well, and in cordial terms too, because the sort of the simile that we always hear is it's like making sausage.
It is. That's a pretty good analogy. And it's you know, we have a very good system of government in our country and in our state, but it's not perfect, and oftentimes it gets hijacked, sometimes by the personalities or by populism or by misrepresenting things. Or one of the things that has distressed me probably as much as anything during my time in public office is this idea that we vilify certain groups or individuals or issues in order to elevate our position. I don't appreciate that. I think it undermines our ability to run and effect good policy. It's, you know, like whether it's public employees, and I say this all the time, you know, it's not the public employees' fault that we have a collective bargaining process. The collective bargaining process was passed by the legislature. So let's not vilify them because they happen to have applied for and gotten a job in public service. And it shouldn't be a bad thing. We do the same thing with labor unions. Sometimes we do it even with teachers. Oh, they make too much money. When in fact, they're teaching kids and giving them an opportunity for their future, you know. And so there's a lot of things that we shouldn't vilify each other because of political parties, because of ethnicity or any of those types of things, but we see it happening. You know, that urban-rural divide sometimes is characterized as, why are we sending all of this money to rural Alaska? Well, there's something called economies of scale. So yeah, it's more expensive in rural Alaska. They don't have roads for the most part. They don't have natural gas, which we get in Cook Inlet and in the state in different places. And they don't have that. They have fuel oil.
Yeah.
And electricity is very high, and they've got freight costs and shipping costs, so that when they get goods into their groceries, even in their communities, or gasoline in their communities, it's very, very expensive. And so it's different. It's more expensive in Alaska, in rural Alaska, just like it's more expensive in Alaska than it is in lower 48.
Yeah.
And we have to keep that in mind about the economies of scale.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the, you mentioned.
One other thing that I want to touch on that's distressing or has been distressing, and that is negative campaigning works, which is why it's used. But my concern with negative campaigning is it undermines our institutions of government, because they're so negative sometimes that whoever's elected then has half the people who don't like them, because they believe, rightly or not, some of the rhetoric and the campaign messages that have been out there. And because the negative campaigning works as well as it does, people use it over and over again, it makes it that much more difficult on the people who get elected to effectively govern.
Is that something, not necessarily at the local level, local politics tend to be a lot more tame than state level, and certainly national politics. At the state level, though, and doing some of those state races, is that something that crept in, the negative campaigning or the higher focus on the next election rather than developing policy? Is that something that you saw change over time when you were in Juneau?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that because of its effectiveness, negative campaigning, and not just negative campaigning, it's focused negative campaigning or focused campaigning. it's become so much more sophisticated. You know, it used to be people would stand on a soapbox and each of them would talk and give a speech. And sometimes the better order would get more votes or, mm-hmm. or more support, and sometimes depending on the message. But it was one-to-one. And some of that may have been communicated secondhand to other people. But what we have now is we have the parties and the operatives who test market slogans, they test market rhetoric, they test market issues, they do focus groups to see what is going to work most to influence people, whether that's fear or misrepresenting or whether it's taxes or any kind of thing. They try to figure out what's best, and then they utilize that in campaigns, often organized campaigns across, you know, the parties, you know, that may say the Democrats are tax and spend, or Republicans want to give all the money to the oil companies. However it might be, whatever those messages are, they test market them in order to influence the public in mm-hmm. votes. And again, it makes it that much more difficult because that's the snapshot that oftentimes the public is making their decision on. It's not the totality of the decisions or the process or the individual and the job that they've done. Oftentimes it can be over one single issue. You know, the when I was in the legislature, they'd always want to, and they still do, they, you know, want to put people on record on a vote.
Yes.
There yep. are literally thousands and thousands of votes that take place in the legislature on amendments, in committees, on the floor. And so you can pick, I'll give you an example, you can pick one vote out and say, Mike Navar voted against increasing education. And here's what happened. They wanted to increase education by $5 million. There was an amendment to increase it by $2.5 million. I voted against it. There was an amendment to increase it by $5 million. I voted for it. So at the end of the day, we increased education. But is it accurate to say I voted against funding, increased funding for education? Well, yes and no. And therein lies the problem
yeah.
in that the public doesn't see that, and it's difficult, I guess, to communicate that effectively to where it's easily grasped. Instead, it's a simple message. Mike Navar is against education.
Well, yeah. What Stephen Colbert so brilliantly termed truthiness.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
some truthiness in that.
Yep.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, going back to the earlier days in the legislature, there were some sort of big names in Alaska politics, going back to the beginning of Alaska politics, that were around, and you've mentioned a couple of them, Clem Tillion, Hugh Malone, who probably, I don't know if enough people understand really the role that he's played in this state and with the PFD and those sorts of things. What did you learn from some of those, for lack of a better term, old timers that were here, you know, tossing ideas around at the very beginning?
Yeah, I had the opportunity actually to serve with a number of those folks who were still in the legislature when I got elected. Hugh Malone wasn't there. I took his seat.
Right.
He was retiring, but I did work with him when he was commissioner of the Department of Revenue under Governor Cooper. So I got a chance to work with him. You know, I still talk to Clem Tillion from time to time. I consider him a friend. We joke about it. He's from Halibut Cove, and I say he always probably voted for me a time or two, and he doesn't always admit to it, but I'm confident because I talked to his late wife, Diana Tillion. She voted for me. his son-in-law is Sam Cotton, who's now the commissioner of Fish and Game, and mm-hmm. Sam and I served in the legislature together and had a great relationship. So I guess I served with a lot of really, really good legislators who were there before I got elected, and some stayed after. But you know, I served with Vic Fisher. Vic Fisher was a delegate to the Constitution, mm-hmm. Constitutional Convention. I served with him in the legislature. Jay Kurtula, Dick Eliason from Sitka, John Coghill's, I served with a number of legislators from Anchorage and, well, from all over the state. You know, Al Adams, he was a incredible native leader and leader in the legislature. He chaired the Finance Committee for years and years in both the House, served in both the House and the Senate. Served with a lot of very good people from here. I've served with Gail Phillips. You know, Gail Phillips was Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
Served with Ramona Barnes, all of these names that you hear about, that were, and there were some, you know, incredibly, like I said, incredibly bright people in the legislature, and some were better communicators than others, but all of them had a role in shaping policy in the state.
And we hope you're enjoying this conversation with Borough Mayor Mike Navar as he reflects on 30 years in Alaska politics. This, of course, part of our slate of all local programming during our two-day fall membership drive. If you found some value in this programming, enjoyed what you have heard so far, hey, give us a call, 283-8433. It seems like, you know, you mentioned Vic Fisher in particular. You know, we have so many sort of legal fights, national level, state level, whatever, always go back to, you know, looking at constitutional matters and what did the founders intend. Alaska is so unique in that when you're a member of the legislature, you, and a question like this comes up, what did the founders intend when they wrote this? You can actually turn probably just a desk or two over and say, Vic, what did you mean? But, and so that, I guess that surprises me a lot that you can have such a direct connection to that document that we base everything off of and still have these questions.
Absolutely. And I had an uncle who also was a delegate to the Constitution Convention, Jim Dugan. Mike Dugan served in the legislature also. That's his son, my cousin. But Jim Dugan was a delegate to Alaska's Constitutional Convention. That was my mother's oldest brother. And he would come down and visit me occasionally. He lived in Fairbanks. He'd come down and visit me and talk to me, and he was kind of a stubborn old guy. He's 100% Irish, but really, really a good guy. Had a career in public service from time to time, but also in the private sector. But he would come down and tell me. He said, and this was his advice to me, he said, don't let anyone tell you that we had it all figured out. We didn't. He said it was just a group of us who were elected to go to be delegates to the Constitutional Convention, and we went and did the best job we can at the time. And he said, things have changed since then. He said, we did the best we could at the time. Now it's your turn. Don't let anybody tell you that anything is sacrosanct or should never be changed. He said, because, you know, things evolve and things change, and it's your job now that you're elected to do it. And that was something that I appreciated him saying, but also that I've remembered, is that, you know, things change and they're going to change. And we're going to see that in Alaska. All of this debate that's going on now is because there's been a monumental shift in where we're at in terms of our economy, what fuels it, where we get our revenues in order to support our spending decisions, things like that. It's changed significantly.
Is it, so you were in Juneau in the 80s, there was a crash then in the oil price. Were there some of the same things that we're talking about now, where they talked about then in terms of we need to figure out how to diversify and we can't rely on this one thing? Or was there always faith that the price will go back up, this is just how it goes, we'll be fine?
No, I think that it's a little bit of the Chicken Little mentality, in that in the 80s when the price of oil dropped, and it did, my first term in the legislature, at the end of my first term, 1986, the price of oil dropped from $26 a barrel, which was much more in today's dollars,
right,
to $9 a barrel. And our revenues dropped significantly. It was a crisis. We didn't have all of the savings accounts the permanent fund wasn't as big because it was relatively new. We didn't have a constitutional budget reserve, so we didn't have as many reserves. And it was really a crisis time. What we did have was litigation that was ongoing with the oil companies over valuations and things like that. And some of those we were able to settle to sort of bridge us through until the price went back up. But the difference then was that production was at 2 million barrels a day. Now it's at 500,000 barrels a day. And so that's different. When people say, well, it's happened before, we've been through these crises before, the price is going to go back up and everything will be fine. It's not. The paradigm has shifted. It's much different now than it was in the 80s. And that economy in the 80s was much more heavily reliant on oil and gas spending. And our economy is a little broader now. Still very, very important. Oil and gas revenues are very important. But in order to encourage continued development and investment in oil and gas in Alaska, we're no longer competing with OPEC countries and global areas to invest that sometimes are not as stable as the United States, and Alaska is part of the United States. That was always one of the things that we could use as an argument. Well, now there's huge finds in oil in Texas. And there always has been, but they found a big, huge new field, the Permian Basin, which is 10 times bigger than Prudhoe Bay.
And technology to produce
and
it.
And technology to produce it. And the same thing in North Dakota. And on the East Coast, there's a bunch of gas, more gas than is in Alaska on the North Slope in the Marcellus Basin on the East Coast. And it's harder to get to. There's some, you have to drill more wells because it's called tight oil or shale oil and gas. Yep. And so you got to drill more wells. It's not the same as conventional, but technology's caught up to the extent that that's who we're competing with for investment. And we have to keep that in mind that you can't. It's not the old formulas. We've got to adapt and change in order to make sure that we keep our economy strong in Alaska. That's why we're talking about a fiscal plan. That's why we're talking about broad-based taxes today.
Yeah, and again, you know, conversations that have been going back and forth depending on what that outlook is for a long time. I want to get back into your run in the legislature, and we get to 96, right? And right. Did you not run for re-election, or did you, was that?
I did not run for re-election. I chose instead to run for borough mayor.
And why move, why come back home, so to say?
Well, for a variety of reasons, you know, we had a growing family business at the time that I was involved with. But as importantly, Don Gilman, who was mayor at the time and was termed out, he was encouraging me that it was, I should run for borough mayor back then, and he supported me, and so I decided, you know, I wanted to come home. You know, traveling, that's the other thing. Back then it was 120-day session. You know, it's tough on you living half the year in one place and half the year elsewhere, and so it's tough, you know, if you're working. And, you know, I'd work part-time either doing commercial fishing or in my dad's tire and auto parts store, and then go back to Juneau. You have to just uproot and go to Juneau.
Yeah, and you're there for 4 to 6 months.
And,
yeah,
and you don't get to come back all that often. You do from time to time, but not all that often. So, but your main focus is and has to be the legislature at that point in time, because you're in session. When you're not in session, it's less demanding, of course, but when you're in session, it's all consuming. There are so many issues, so much information, so many meetings that it's difficult to fit anything into that mix. And I think that's something that oftentimes the public doesn't see, is that, you know, sometimes people don't run for re-election because, you know, either their family went with them or wasn't able to go with them because they don't want to uproot their kids from school for 3 or 4 months a year now, half the year in Juneau, half the year in a different school, you know. So they, if you have to leave your family behind, that's difficult enough on its own. And yep. So I didn't have that problem because I wasn't married, didn't have kids, and so it was not as difficult on me. But it really is difficult on families, and you see that, and it wears people out. But it is tough on relationships. I went through a number of relationships because, hey, your girlfriend doesn't like you to be gone 4 months of the year, mm-hmm. and she doesn't get to see you for yep. that period of 4 or 5 months of the year, depending. Mm-hmm. We had special sessions in those days, not quite as many as they're having these days, but this is a difficult time.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're back in the borough, and what were some of the issues in that campaign in your first run for borough mayor? What were the things around people? The budget, obviously, always at the forefront.
The budget's always an issue and should always be an issue, but same types of things. It was education issues, road issues, and then, you know, fiscal policy, overall budget, yeah. and how that's going to be managed. But, you know, I was fortunate to come in on the heels of Don Gilman being mayor, and so the it was a relatively smooth transition at the time. The thing is that Don had done it for so long because term limits were put in place when he was mayor,
mm-hmm.
And he was a good mayor. He was a mayor for 14 out of 18 years leading up to when I became mayor, and he made it look easy. And so When I got elected in 96 and I took over the job, I had no idea what I was getting into.
Because that's a way different gig than being a legislator.
Absolutely.
This is an administrative position.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a strong mayor, which means that the mayor is the manager. And you get hit from, you know, issues from Seward to Homer to Nikiski, Hope, Kenai-Soldotna. You've got service areas that you've got to deal with. You've got a variety of different issues, sometimes flooding, but it's really a big management job. You're managing a whole bunch of different departments and overseeing service areas and a management of service areas that are fairly big budgets, a lot of personnel issues, things that you just can't imagine are going to come your way. And as mayor, you know, the buck really does stop at your desk. You're called upon to weigh in on decisions, and at the end of the day, you try to get good people in positions and let them do their jobs. But at the end of the day, everything falls on your shoulders as the chief manager. Final decisions come down to you, and brainstorming on different issues with department heads or with personnel in the departments on issues that they're dealing with and trying to help them with them, or they want to run something by you. It is incredibly time-consuming, and can be overwhelming at times. And then, in addition to that, you've got people who around the borough who want you to go to their open houses or their community meetings or their service area board meetings. And so there's a lot of driving.
Or their radio shows.
Oh yeah, radio shows.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm doing this one this afternoon. I'm going to Homer tomorrow morning.
It never stops, does it?
Yeah.
So what
and that's on top of the job that you're doing, managing, which is
the quote unquote 9-to-5, which is
it's difficult. And I fortunately have had very, very good help. The department heads, the two chiefs of staffs that I've had, the administrative assistants in my office have done outstanding jobs.
Yeah. We hope you're enjoying our conversation with outgoing Borough Mayor Mike Navarre, looking back on his 30-year political career on the Kenai Peninsula and the state legislature. If you've enjoyed the local programming we've been bringing to you these past couple of days during KDLL's fall membership drive, hey, give us a call, 283-8433. That's the only way that we can keep local programs coming at you, or visit us online at kdll.org. Watching your dad do it and being close to other mayors in the past still probably doesn't explain a half of what you have to know as the person actually in that seat, no matter how many mayors you watch, no matter how close you are to those mayors.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because everybody's a little bit different. Everybody sees things and looks at things and has a little bit of we're all products of our own experiences and education and things like that. And so we make decisions differently. We are influenced by different factors. And so it's difficult to get a grasp on all the different nuances of the incredible management job that you have. You've got your hands full on a daily basis, and you never know from day to day what's going to hit you. And I've always had an open door policy, so I get people who stop by my office who want to complain about any number of things, or sometimes they stop by to say thank you or just because they're looking for some kind of information about any number of things. So it's
was your father still alive when you first got into borough mayor?
Yes.
Office?
And
yes. And he was supportive of that and didn't say, good luck, kid.
No, my father's advice to me when I first told him I was going to run for the legislature in 1984, he said, son, it's a difficult job, and it's an important job, but it can be a really thankless job. He said, but somebody's got to do it, and you'd be good at it. That was his advice to me, and people can debate whether or not I've been good at it, but I think I know my folks were both, when I was first elected, they were both alive, and when I was first elected mayor, they were both alive, and I think they were proud of me, and I was thrilled, you know, to follow in my dad's footsteps as mayor, and I go to work every day in building that's named after him. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a rare thing. You know, I think most kids when they're growing up, there's at least some stage of really looking up to dad, especially, or you know, whatever your same gendered parent typically.
Yep.
And then, but very few people actually go on to pursue anything even resembling that same kind of a career. And in this case, in public service. And as we mentioned, it's throughout the whole family.
Absolutely, and nobody does it on their own in politics. I've been very fortunate to have the support of my family, a large family, my folks, my brothers and sisters, and an incredible number of people in the community who you can't do it without them. And so without that support, I guess I would not have been successful because I wouldn't have gotten elected. But more than that, they keep me grounded too. You know, I hear from people who sometimes will say, I disagree with you on that. And the ones I appreciate the most are the ones who disagree, but they're not so mad at me that we can't have a dialogue about mm-hmm. it. You know, the ones who get mad and are so upset they don't want to talk to me, that's more difficult because, you know, I try to make my decisions as best I can in the public interest. That's what I've always done. I've digested the information. I've worked hard at it. I've tried to understand the issues. I've sorted through information and tried to decide what's good and what's bad. I've talked to people, and then I try to make what I think are informed, responsible decisions in the public interest. And, you know, I promised early in my first campaign and as I ran for mayor on different occasions that I was going to make mistakes, and I have. No question that you make mistakes when you're in office because you're not infallible. We're human beings, and what I've tried to do is learn from my mistakes. If I've gone in the wrong direction, I'm not afraid to say, you know what, I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to do something different because I've got more information. Sometimes you're called upon to make decisions, and you only have – it's time-sensitive. You've got a little bit of information, but you have to – it's an emergent issue. You've got to make a decision based on the information you have, and it may be, because it's limited information, maybe the wrong decision. And what I've always tried to do is, if you get more information that says, you know what, that decision was wrong, now that we have more information, I've not been afraid to say, you know what, we need to go in a different direction, we need to change this because we have new information. But you have to sometimes make decisions with very little information. Other times you can wait. You don't have to make a snap decision. You can wait to get more information. And that's what I've tried to do. I'm deliberative about the way I do it, about the way I do my job and about the way I make my decisions. But sometimes you have to make it with very little information.
I'm curious about your process of kind of working through issues with people. The reason I bring this up is because, and I'm sure for folks who have known you in the community for a long time, that they've also seen a similar scene. Without giving away too much information, at a local establishment, I have witnessed you and your brothers passionately discussing things. And growing up in that setting with a bunch of brothers and a bunch of siblings and trying to get your voice heard and all these different ideas, that has to have played a huge role in simply the ability to get your voice heard in this, even on the Kenai Peninsula, in this sea of all these opinions, to, in a respectful way, get your voice heard and use the platform that you have, kind of.
You know, and sometimes it wears on you because when you're in office, if you don't have more information about the policy decisions and information about any particular issue, you're really not doing your job because you've got access to it. And that's why we have this form of government that we do, this representative form of government. It's the job of the elected official to sort through that information, to digest it, and make informed, responsible decisions. That's what I think. The public doesn't always have access to that same information, and they may form their opinions and their perspectives on other information that may not be accurate or may be dated information. And so, you know, what I have learned to do, and I think I've gotten better with it over time, is try to help educate the public from the things that I know and boil it down to I guess, an executive summary of issues and give them my perspective, benefit of my perspective, without, you know, being arrogant about the knowledge that I have, because that's part of my job, is to digest that information. And, you know, the representative form of government we have is because we elect people to do that work for us, our elected officials. And that's because we all have our lives to live. You know, people have relationship issues. They have kids that they have to deal with. They have their jobs and their activities and their hobbies and all kinds of things that they're dealing with on a daily basis, you know, health issues, any number of things. So that's their focus and their priority. And they expect, I think rightfully so, that the people that they elect are going to educate themselves on those issues. At the same time, they want to be able to criticize the decisions that are made. And that's one of the things I think I've gotten better about, is not taking it so personally and then trying to explain how I got to my decisions. And I think it's one of the things that I hope that people appreciate about me as an elected official, is that the way I go about making my decisions.
You know, something that I've noticed watching the assembly for the past few years is that, you know, you can get into some really intense sort of debates almost with folks who have come to speak about this issue or that issue. And I've heard you have conversations with people about just, and you kind of brought it up, that just the nature of this system of government that we have.
Yeah, that's something that I think I tell people. My degree is in government. My college degree is in government. It's a BA in government. I have a minor in economics. I may be the only elected official who actually has a degree in government. I say that jokingly, there's not that many who have government degrees. But that's the sort of educational aspect of government, the practical aspects and the practical application of government, how it works, is much, much different than the theoretical educational background that I got. So yeah, it's difficult to explain and engage people in discussions about either issues or government structure, government decisions, when they don't have the same background and understanding that I do. And so it'd be like oil geologist trying to explain to me how oil comes out of the ground. You know, we're at different levels, and so you got to boil it down, or try to boil it down to understandable, in an understandable way, so that you can communicate and people are able to understand it. You can't try to download everything that you have in your experience to them in one conversation. You got to try to boil it down to where it's in understandable terms, recognizing that you know, people have different levels of understanding about things.
And not only in one conversation, but I feel like some of these conversations have probably been going on for a long, long time with certain people.
Oh, absolutely. And they're influenced, and they have their own perspectives, and people have opinions, and sometimes they're very good opinions, and sometimes they're loudly uninformed decisions or opinions. And that, you know, that's just the nature of the beast in our society. And we see it all the time. Some people hold on to their opinions and their positions fairly strongly. Sometimes you can't convince them. And sometimes people look at it, you know, one of the things that has been frustrating for me a little bit in politics is that, you know, I registered when I was in high school, because you could register for your birthday. And while I was 17, when I graduated, my birthday was coming up, and they had someone come around and register kids in school. And so I registered. I registered as a Democrat because my folks were Democrats. But I've never taken and gone into any job to represent the Democratic Party. You know, I go there to represent the public interest. That's how I see my job. Now, other people in office may do things differently, but I've had people say, well, I'm never voting for you because you're a Democrat. Well, wait a minute, don't you want to hear my position on these issues? And so we characterize people based on sometimes their affiliations. I talked about it a little bit earlier, you know, whether you're a union member or a public employee or someone from rural Alaska or a commercial fisherman or a sport fisherman. We sometimes tend to vilify based on those associations, which I think undermines and hurts the ability to communicate effectively about what our positions really are. Because I've come to the conclusion that, you know, we're not all that far apart on any of the issues. The rhetoric and sometimes political parties and polarize us further than we should be. And I think that if we can come together and seek compromise, which is something that I think worked better years ago. I remember, you know, Ted Stevens, the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act was Warren Magnuson was a Democratic senator from Washington. Ted Stevens was a Republican senator from Alaska. They worked together in the best interest of the constituencies in Washington, Alaska, and across the USA, and we see less and less of that now, where we're talking about, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, they're trying to get to 50 votes from the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of, hey, how about if we have 25 from each? Wouldn't that really be a better compromise? But the politics of campaigning and electioneering sometimes doesn't allow that anymore, and that's really a sad commentary on our ability to work together in the interest of all of us.
Yeah, that's a topic that we could go on for a long, long time, and I know you have other places to go. I just wanted to wrap up with, you know, my sense being that if it weren't for term limits for the borough mayor, that your name might be on that ballot again this year. But the things being what they are there other plans? Or are we going to? You seem like you've got way too much energy left, and still playing softball to just retire to the golf course already.
You know, I think that it's one of those things that I have come to realize more and more, especially over the last several years, where I've been working with the legislature and the governor, and both governors actually. I worked with Governor Parnell, and all. I mean, I've worked with every governor. In order to try to affect good public policy. And I've told Governor Walker I would help him with fiscal policy, and I don't know in what capacity that's going to be. I was down there last year during the special session trying to help with communications. I'm going to do that again. I want to help, not because it's Governor Walker, but because it's important, I think, to the economic future of Alaska that we get something in place. And I have a good rapport with both Republicans and Democrats, so I would like to try to help be a facilitator of some kind in order to reach compromise, which seems like, as we've talked about, has become increasingly difficult. If there weren't term limits, I probably would run again, because I've got a great administrative team in place. I think there's good morale and tremendous public employees. And, you know, I defend them a lot because I get to see them every day, how hard they work, their commitment to their jobs. I mean, they do a good job. And are there some who we have difficulties with? Sure. In any environment that you have 300 employees, you're going to have some times where there's issues or that come up, whatever, because they're all human beings. But I have experienced and I guess observed on a daily basis the commitment that the people who work for the borough show to their jobs and the way they carry out their jobs. And so I've been impressed by it, and I've been very fortunate. We've got, as I said, excellent directors and very good personnel throughout all the departments who really care about their jobs, and they care about the borough.
Yeah.
And that's important.
And one last one. Don't know if I'll get you to give me an answer on this one or not. Do you have a vote for borough mayor?
Yes, I am. I am supporting Linda because Linda has always supported me. You know, despite the fact that she's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. I also had a great relationship with her mom. Her mom was a Democratic mayor of the city of Soldotna. I guess I shouldn't say that. She was a mayor of this Soldotna, but she was also on the borough assembly. And she is one of the people who helped me when I was a young legislator in public office with good advice and encouragement, and was always an extraordinary supporter of mine. And so, you know, I appreciate that, and I've talked to Linda. I think that Linda will do a good job managing, and so I'm going to support her.
All right. Very good. Well, that's sounds like you've got other places to go. I just really appreciate you coming in today and ruminating a bit about a long and successful, I think, career in Alaska politics, and thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Shaylin. I appreciate the opportunity.
And that was my conversation with Borough Mayor Mike Navar as he prepares to leave office. We'll have the entirety of that conversation, if you missed any portion of it, on our website, kdll.org. kdll.org, also a great place to go if you would like to show your support for your local public radio station. We've been bringing you as much local programming as we possibly can these past 2 days to show you our commitment to the Central Kenai Peninsula, the communities that we are happy to serve. If that's meant something to you, if you found it interesting, informative, entertaining, and you found some value in it, hey, give us a call, 283-8433. It's really the only way that we can continue to bring you programming like this day after day, the programming that you trust and rely on. We're happy to do it, but we can only do it with your support. Really easy, 283-8433, or again, go online to kdll.org. Right now, though, as we get to the top of the 4 o'clock hour, time for NPR's All Things Considered.